Welcome to another of my shows. I am your host and producer, Isabel Jubes. This is an archive show of La Ventana Americana. You can find this show and all the information related to it, together with more of my archive productions, on StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org. Visit our website and be part of this, giving me your opinions and more about your ideas. This is La Ventana Americana.
La Ventana Americana.
La Ventana Americana.
Esto es La Ventana
La Ventana Americana.
La Ventana Americana.
La Ventana de la radio 90.1 KCSU Stanford.
From KCSU Stanford 90.1.
Desde KCSU Stanford.
KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM.
This is La Ventana Americana from KCSU Stanford 90.1.
KZSU 90.1 FM.
And the program is La Ventana Americana.
A window to the Latin universe from Stanford to the world. I am Isabel Jubes.
And I'm Elizabeth Trachtenberg.
Welcome, bienvenido. Today, in La Ventana Americana, we have two scientists who are in the search of the Latin genome. They have joined forces in their different fields of expertise to realize this important research. They are Doctor in Anthropology, Carla Sandoval Mendoza.
It's very important just to have this data, because with genetic data you have a more accurate information, and you can date the human migrations. And you can compare also with the historical or with the archaeological records.
And researcher, medical doctor, and geneticist, Andrés Moreno Estrada.
Basically, we were able to separate the Native American portion of the genome, like, and they do have a higher similarity with South American tribes that currently live in actually inland Amazonian regions, for example. We had data from different regions throughout the Americas.
And stay today with us in La Ventana Americana, transmitting from KCSU Stanford 90.1 FM. For more information, remember that you can go to our website, laventanaamericana.com. And we're back here at La Ventana Americana. And today we're going to talk about looking for the Latin American genome.
Dr. Carla Sandoval Mendoza is doing a postdoc at Bustamante Lab at Stanford School of Medicine. And Dr. Andrés Moreno Estrada is a research associate at the same laboratory. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the invitation.
What is the subject that you study?
Formally speaking, it's called population genetics, and that's a classic discipline that has been out there for decades now. The advancement of technology has actually been allowed to extend the genetic analysis in general for the whole genome. So now we call genomics in general, because we study the whole genome. That's kind of the new term of saying, well, I'm not doing only single gene stuff or just genetics in general, as I used to be, you know, with my single favorite gene or whatever. But I'm doing genomics in terms of, you know, having lots and lots of data being produced for the whole genome. I'm talking about the whole set of chromosomes for one individual. So either we put the, you know, DNA samples into a machine that generates data from variable size, or we actually sequence the whole sequence of letters that make up all the genome. So,
what kind of information can you get from a person with that?
Strictly speaking, we just get their variants, basically reading their sequence in terms of letters. I mean, there are only four different letters that make up the genetic code, represented by their initials, A, C, G, and T. Basically, that's what we get. That's all we get. We get at this particular position, this individual has an A or a T or a C or a G. But since we can get that from many individuals at a larger scale and for all the positions, or at least many positions of a single individual, we can make up what is the profile of this particular individual. I mean, it would be like a barcode if you want, right? I mean, this guy has ACG and then TTAA and so on. That's what makes your own identity in terms of, you know, in genetic terms. Then we can compare that profile with many other individuals, and then we cluster individuals that look alike in a particular, you know, pattern that they, and then we correlate that with the affiliation, and then it turns out that all these all come from the same population and so on. But then we see mixing events, and then we see, well, these guys share some signature that is partially from this population but also from this other one, and it's all what we call admixture, right? So
when I grow up, when you say what I study at school, when you talk about what it means to be a Latin or Latino in general, where the people were who are descendant of the Romans, who were coming from the countries where the Roman Empire actually was there and actually kept the language, the Romance language from Latin, and that's where Latin come from. So that embodied, in a way, France, Spain, Portugal, even Romania, that people that actually, well, may have certain looks, but mostly kept something out of that culture. And then, of course, when Spain came and discovered a new land and colonized, then there came the Portuguese, even the Dutch and the Hollands, and a lot of people came and start mixing with the tribes that were already in the land. I suppose that's where the Latin American come. But so that's how we all in our Latin American countries grow up thinking that we are Latinos because we come from from that root in particular, and we speak a Latin language. But when you come to the United States, apparently something completely different. We are not connected to that. So we want to ask you, what does it mean to be Latino? The experts, who else can tell that?
So that's totally right that Latin American inherited that term from colonial times or afterwards. It's a way that defines a really huge geographical area, right? Basically, south of the United States border all the way to the southern tip of South America, right? So, and it's true that embodies that whole region is definitely the language, and that's been the case from most of the countries that speaks in most of them Spanish, although some other them, you know, have inherited, you know, Portuguese as an official language or some other European languages. But it's true that in a way that is some of a cultural identity of putting in the same term what a Latino population or what a Latino individual means. So in the United States, and this is something also new to us because we were not, you know, we were not living in the States until very recently, a couple of years ago or 3 years ago, where here populations where they are well more used to the fact that they are immigrants from any part of the world, right? So they attach the American suffix after whatever you are, right? So in this case, either you are a European American, African American, or in our case, Mexican Americans and so on, right? So, but within these Latino roots, there's also a broad group of people that identify themselves as Hispanic or Latinos. And even within this term, there's kind of a little bit of controversy, what exactly, why Hispanic, why / Latino, because some of them are actually Latinos because they come from Latin America, but still they not all of them speak Spanish, right? So that you can have, you know, some people from the Caribbean islands, they do speak French, for example. They're still considered, for some of them may be considered part of Latin America, for some other will just put it as a separate category within the Caribbean, for example, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different divisions and definitions how we can address ourselves in terms of population, how we trace back our identity to our roots. And ultimately, what we do in our lab is to try to trace those roots in genetic terms. So where do we come from in terms of what we have inherited from our ancestors in their genes, right?
So, for example, let's say many of the people that are live in South American countries, they are immigrants that came from Germany or Russia, but today will be considered South American and Latinian, but don't have any Latinian traits.
Well, you would be surprised. I mean, that's one of the questions that
that's one of the questions. When the way that we used to worry is to do, after all this genetic analysis, the first step is just to have an approach with a target population that is really interesting for us and population that we can answer some questions. For example, Latin American populations are very important for us because they have a different kind of ancestry. For example, the Native American ancestry that is in our genes, in our records, and also the European ancestry, and in some populations, an African ancestry. For example, in our case that we have been working with Latin American population from Mexico, we can found these three different ancestry. So, and when you apply some genealogies questionnaires to these populations, they only replied you that they have only a European ancestry, not a native ancestry, because in some parts of Mexico, it's like, a, I don't know, not a good thing to have a native ancestry. But now it's start changing a little bit. But when you see the results, the genetic results, you see that the history is completely different because you can find some European ancestry, some native ancestry, and some African ancestry in almost all, well, that depends on the part of the mestizo or mixed population that we are studying. So,
right. So like you said before, I mean, unless you have a very clear, extremely recent ancestors from Europe directly that haven't mixed actually with any local population within Argentina, for example, or wherever in Latin America, then yes, you could actually assure that you have no Native American ancestry, possibly. I mean, still, I would have my doubts because Carla said, there's a really large proportion of the population that trace back their ancestors, at least from the maternal side. That's what we have seen, like the most common ancestry from the maternal lineage actually comes from a Native American population, right? So that means that there has been a tremendous bias as well in how the mixture has occurred, yep. Right? So even though people can self-identify as mostly European, or even though most of the grandparents are very well traced back to Germany or whatever, they would be surprised that maybe possibly back some generations ago, they actually trace back their maternal inheritance from a Native American woman, for example, right? So that's one of the things that we want to trace back in terms of not only the individual case, but also the population level. And how is that differentially distributed across different regions in Latin America? Because the pattern could be very different in Argentina and Chile, which have had a lot of recent European immigration than, for example, what Carla mentioned in Mexico, where there was a larger proportion of Native American populations contributing to present-day mestizos, mm-hmm. right? So depending where you look in Latin America, you will get different patterns.
So there are, in fact, big immigrations from the wars, but still they have been mixing in the last 100 years. There are other countries that have a bigger population of Native American.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, for example, Carla has been working in Peru a lot, which is, you know, one of the countries that has the largest proportion of Native American ancestry by far. So, yeah.
Mexico, Peru, also Guatemala, Ecuador, and mm-hmm. Bolivia, mm-hmm. is all these countries have a lot of Native American populations that are alive.
In your presentation in the Center of Latin American Studies, you mentioned something about two very important African immigrations that were significant in the determination of the populations with the Native Americans. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, actually, that was a very interesting project to be involved with, and that was a collaboration with the University of Miami, who did a tremendous work sampling individuals whose ancestors come from different countries of the Caribbean. So that was actually kind of the Caribbean Diversity Project to try to reconstruct what are the roots of Caribbean people now living in Miami, for example, as a recruiting point. But since they trace back their origins to different places within the Caribbean, we were able to reconstruct actually the fine scale origin of each of these islands, right? So we had samples from 4 different islands: Cuba, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, and Haiti, and also from surrounding mainland populations, including Honduras and Colombia, for example. And we also had data from Mexico, right? So we compared all that. And we saw that, indeed, there was a lot of African ancestry in all 4 islands, right? I mean, way higher than the other 3 mainland populations, which is also what we have been observing in other genetic analysis and also makes sense with the history of the region, because the islands have been much closer with the traditional roots of the transatlantic slave trade. So these populations have been much more exposed to the arrival of incoming migrants from Africa. And that happened all the way back between the 16th century up until the 19th century, right? So during those roughly 400 years of importation, of forced importation of African slaves, we not only can estimate how much of that waves of migration have impacted their genome of the present-day Afro-Caribbean persons, but also we could identify the time of the arrival of these pulses of migration and where do they come from within Africa. So to do that, we applied different statistical methods and analytical methods that basically take apart the different ancestries within a person's genome. And to do that, what we do initially is to gather data from all the genome of each of the individuals, and that's basically what we generate in the lab. We generate genomic data, which is basically just analyzing a bunch of variable positions that differentiate one individual to the other. And since we know how a variant that has originated in Africa or in Europe or in Asia look like, we can actually say, well, this particular individual from the Caribbean in this position, in this particular chromosome, does it look like coming from Africa or Europe or Asia or so on?
Right? And from this part of Africa or from the East Coast or the West Coast of Africa?
Right. So that's very dependent if I have a true answer or pattern about how does the source population look like, so that I can actually distinguish my target individual, if you like, as to where he or she comes from, right? So if I only had like one reference, for example, from Africa, I will only be able to tell, well, does it look African or not, or European or African versus Asian, right? But I will not be able to tell within the African portion of the genome, does it look like it comes from this particular region within Africa or not? So it is only thanks to the fact that previous studies have been generated so much data from a lot of populations within each of the continents that we were able to do this comparison much more finer scale.
TV is an independent, publicly supported non-profit TV platform that reaches 35 million households in the U.S. Using both television and the internet, Free Speech TV inspires viewers to become civically engaged in building a more just, equitable, and sustainable society. You can get involved by joining an online community, subscribing to the e-guide or RSS feeds, sharing videos, of course, making a donation. For more information, visit freespeech.org.
Why do we need this data?
Well, first, just to reconstruct the history of the population from an anthropological point of view, that's the main thing that we want to see, if genetics can complement.
To reconstruct what we know from history.
Right? So Carla knows very well as an anthropologist that this has been done so far, very well done actually, from linguistics, from historical records.
Archaeological records. Linguistic records also.
Even from genetics as well. I mean, we're not the first ones to do any genetic study in the Caribbean, of course, but the scale is what matters, right? So far, people have been analyzing smaller parts of the genome, which is traditionally known as, for example, the mitochondrial genome, which is a smaller part of the genome, or the Y chromosome, because it has, you know, a non-recombining region, which means basically that transmits, you know, without recombination through generations. But it is, or it was, more challenging or also more expensive to analyze the rest of the genome at a larger scale, right? So by generating all this additional data, we get finer resolution maybe to very long-standing questions, right? As, for example, in the Caribbean, where does the Native American tribes come from, right? Even though we have partial answers from historical records and from linguistics, does the genomic data tell us something different that we didn't know before, right? Or can we refine those answers? And that's why we need this type of data, right?
What did you find that we didn't know before?
Basically, we were able to separate the Native American portion of the genome, like, and they do have a higher similarity with South American tribes that currently live in actually inland Amazonian regions, for example. So we had data from different regions throughout the Americas, including actually the closest coasts nearby the Caribbean. I mean, that's the northeastern coast of Colombia, for example, Venezuela as well. We had some tribes from Venezuela, precisely because we said, well, these are the guys living closest to the islands, and maybe they share a genetic similarity with our genes that come from the Caribbean islands. Turns out that they're not. Actually, inland population from further south, like East Colombia, but that are already east of the Andes, that means inland Colombia in Amazonian regions, Brazil, even further south to the north of Paraguay, the Guyanas as well, populations that all share a signature that is much more similar to the genetic signature in the Caribbean. I mean, I'm talking about only the Native American portion of the Caribbean. And this explains that why these people also used to speak a language that is very related to the present-day people that live in the Amazon. I'm talking about particularly about the Arawak language. So the Arawak-speaking groups are a very large group of different tribes that live, like I said, in a very broad area that spans from North and South America all the way down to northern Argentina. The Arawakan expansion is actually known to have occurred about roughly 2,500 years ago. And the route that was, you know, much more accepted that they follow was precisely through the Lesser Antilles and then all the way up to the Greater Antilles. So the fact that the Native American genes from our Miami individuals actually cluster or have a genetic signature that is very similar to these populations inland supports that hypothesis, right? What we are adding on top of that is the fact that apparently populations that were close by, like even the Colombian coast or Venezuelan coast, that actually didn't contribute that much to the actual genetic composition of present-day Caribbeans, right? So basically it was a single expansion apparently occurred once, like about 2,500 years ago, like I said, and apparently was exactly the population that the Europeans encountered by their arrival, right?
So, for example, the Indians that in Venezuela we call the Caribbeans, they are not actually related with the other islanders?
Mm-hmm. In Venezuela, particularly, we had samples from three populations, the Yucpa, Warao, and the Bari. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have samples from Caribs, themselves, because mm-hmm. the Caribs actually were known to be peopling the Caribbean before the European contact, mm-hmm. together with the Taínos, which were mm-hmm. the largest group at the time. So it's possibly true that the Caribs, if they were actually in Venezuela, that they could be related to the genetic portion of Caribbeans. But, however, Caribs, as far as I understand, were mostly inhabiting only in the islands, right? Not in the nearby coasts.
Okay. Because, for example, then the Guajiros, which are also in Colombia and in Venezuela, they look different than how the Pemones or the ones from the Amazon look like. I mean, and different to Timotocuicas, which are from Los Andes. So I suppose they came sometime in the same big migration of humans, but how related those?
Right, definitely all the tribes that currently are in the old Amazonian region, even though there's a diverse group of tribes, there's not only Arawakan-speaking tribes. Of course, there are many, many others. But what the data points to is that there was a subset of those individuals, the ones that most likely went up north in a single migration, and those were mostly closely related to the Arawakan-speaking ones. I'm talking about the Ticuna, for example, the Wahibo, also Caritiana from Brazil, and all those are the ones that shared the signature among them and also shared the signature with the ones in the Caribbean. So all the others that were in mainland or currently in mainland, apparently, they are very differentiated also from the Arawakan-speaking ones, and they basically didn't contribute really that much to the pattern of in the Caribbean, right?
So, like, for example, your previous question, when you were asking if we know from which part of Africa came that part of the genome. So with these kind of methods, you can say...
It's actually from both points of view, we have new answers, if you want. Mm-hmm. Actually, from the African ancestry and also from the Native American, right, which is the one we were talking before.
And then what is interesting about this research is that you got together and are looking at it from both points of view. You are looking at it from the biological point of view, looking at the genes and studying the DNA of all these people, but you are also looking at the movements of the people from the anthropological and statistical point of view. How did you came together to this way to look at the at this research?
That's a good question.
So, but, by the way, they are married.
You are listening to the first 60,000 base pairs of the human genome translated into musical pitch frequency by aligning the 22 amino acids to a musical scale. To chromosome 1 from the Yuma Genome Quorum sequence, translated to music by Stuart Mitchell. You are listening to La Ventana Americana on KZSU, Stanford 90.1 FM, on air every Tuesday from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m.
Stay with us here at La Ventana Americana, transmitting on KCSU 90.1 FM.
What? But you say they came north, didn't they? All come from Siberia and Alaska and went down all the way. That wasn't that how the population moved? The humans got to America?
Oh yes, yeah. I mean, in general to the continent, yes. But I'm talking only about the recent migration from South America to the Caribbean islands, which happened way much more recently than the original expansion into the Americas, which happened like 10,000 years ago.
10,000 years ago, yeah.
So, Carla, can you describe the way that they came 10,000 years ago?
They crossed the Beringian Bridge, because it was a bridge that was an ice bridge. So they crossed to the Beringian. So, and they stayed there for a long time in Beringian just to generate a new genetic diversity. So it was the same genetic diversity that was found in the east of Asia. But they incubate a new kind of genetic diversity, and after that, they continue migrating from north through the south of the continent.
So in America, they came through the north, and they got to the Caribbean because it was the most friendly weather
to stay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they kept moving south.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also, well, there is a different theories about the how was the migration, because there are different theories. One of the main theories is that probably they stayed for an incubation in the other part of the Beringian, and then came from the north to the south, inlands. Or there is another theory that could be just for the coast, or also two migrations, one inland and the other for the coast of the continent. In the past, we used to take only in account is archaeological records. So one of the oldest archaeological records in South America is one is located in Brazil and the other is located in the South America, and then it's dated around 12,000. Well, that depends of the method that the archaeologists apply to date the archaeological site. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, it's very important just to have this data, because with genetic data, you have more accurate information, and you can date the human migrations, and you can compare also with the historical or with the archaeological records.
Also, Chile has a very ancient places, right?
Yeah, also Chile.
Chile has also many sites. But, I mean, Carla is right in the sense that all these need to be carbon dated through other means that you can estimate roughly how old they are. So what genetics is currently doing is either complementing the information that we get from archaeology or actually putting into the table new hypotheses how the continent was colonized, because there's a surprisingly fast migration that is hypothesized to have occurred from north to south. But since these places are very close in terms of the dating, the ones that are in southern South America and the ones that are, for example, in the U.S., there are some sites that are part of the Clovis culture, for example, that have been dated also very anciently, right? So the only explanation for them being so close in time is that either humans moved really, really fast from north to south, or we are missing some pieces to the puzzle, right? Could it be that they went actually down that fast that they colonized South America first, and then a second wave of migration was the one that actually replaced most of humans until we have, you know, other dates from North America? Or are the dates just need to be corrected, or what is going on there, right? So that's what genetics is trying to complement. But we're talking about different layers, if you want, of different diversity arriving to different parts of the world at different times. So the Americas is so complex because it involves this ancient migration of Native Americans. And on top of that, then you have all these intercontinental contacts after European arrival, right? So that all these pattern that we're talking about gets way more complicated 500 years ago when Europeans arrive and then they, I quote, you know, discover this new island. It's even the whole term of new world is a very Eurocentric term, right? To call a whole new area that they haven't colonized before, then, well, here they are. And immediately they discover new resources, and they need force of labor actually to actually colonize the whole region. And that's how Africans also are brought soon after, actually, a very, very few years after European contact. And or those events are also registering in through the genes. So that's what we have been recovering through this analysis of the data, right?
Well,
How did you come together with the research and the data with your anthropological statistic?
So I think that, for example, it's very important to do a previous anthropological investigation, especially because I think that all the populations that we have been working so need a kind of respect. So you have to be very respectful with all the traditions, cultures, and everything, you know. And I think that if you just decide to go directly to the population and to try to explain the project but without any information, that could be a complete mess, you know, because working with native populations, even that are very close in the same territory, you can find very different cultural traditions. For example, for some populations, they are more than happy to participate in your study and they are very open, but other populations are totally disagree with this kind of research. So the first step is to have a kind of super fast ethnography of the population that you want to study and try to understand which is the normal way of life of that population that you really want to approach. And after that, we have to meet with the local authorities. That is, in some cases, is completely different local authorities and the politics authorities, because in some populations, they have a Consejo de Ancianos.
And the Elders Council?
Some native authorities that you have to approach and you have to stand your project and everything. And after that, you have an authorization just to start contact the populations. And it's very important to give an informative talks, just to present who are you, what are you very interested in to work with that population, and just to give, just to ask for the permission to realize the work and your research in that place. So it's very important. And also just to have in mind which is the best way to do it. For example, in some populations, they are totally agreed to give you a blood sample or a saliva sample, but other kind of populations, they only can give you, I don't know, a hair sample, or that depends on the beliefs of the populations. So, for example, in my case, I had the opportunity to work with a very isolated population in the south of Mexico, that is a place called Oaxaca, and the population was the Triqui. And I remember that it was very shocking for me because when I just explained my work, they decided just to give me a blood sample instead of hair or instead of saliva, because they related the blood with something new, something good, something very good, instead of giving me hair, because the hair, it was a kind of maleficio, I don't know how.
Okay.
Yeah, something bad.
How did you manage with the language there?
Well, in almost all the Latin American countries, we have the advantage that almost all these populations are bilinguals, especially with young people. So, but when you go with these particular councils, that you have this problem that they are monolingual, you have to look for a person that can help you to translate everything. When I started working with native populations, I remember that was a little bit concerning for me because I was asking for permission and I present myself and everything together. So, and the person who was helping me, that we call informante, I don't know how to translate.
Informant
person. So I remember that I was speaking like, I don't know, 10 minutes. He translated my question like in 1 minute question. It was like, okay. Is everything okay? So, yeah. And for that reason, you have to be very alert about just to interpret even body language and all different kind of communications.
Sorry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have another example if you want to put another anecdote to that. We actually got married in an indigenous community in southern Mexico, in Chiapas, right? So they speak three different Mayan languages there, right? So Tzotzil, Tojolabal, and then Sok as well. But the main ones, Tzotzil and Tojolabal, are the ones that are mostly spoken, right? So in our wedding ceremony, the one that was basically with the microphone and present, because we were getting married in front of the whole village, basically, right? In a big auditorium and everything.
Beautiful.
So we wanted to have like a small ceremony within their usual ceremony, which they do once a month and everything. But the whole village got so excited that they all came to see how come it's, you know, these two guys are getting married here. So the guy was presenting the whole ceremony. he was translating everything into, I mean, speaking Spanish, but translating everything into Tzotzil and Toholabal, right? So whenever he, you know, he was speaking for minutes and minutes and well presenting, here we have Andres and Carla, they come from these parts of Mexico, blah, 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 and they are here to get married. And then the translation into in the other two languages were like just immediately, right?
Two words.
We were like, okay, is that all that we said? Because everything we were saying was also translated into two different languages, right? So after all the translations into both languages, I think the whole thing took like 8 hours or something like that.
Yeah. It was fantastic. 4 hours, not eight hours.
The ceremony was 4 hours?
Four hours.
That's fantastic. You got tired.
Yeah.
But I bet it's an amazing memory. Did your family travel all the way to the village? No.
Actually, no. They were not allowed. The community actually accepted to having us to get married in the village, with actually one of the conditions being that only the two of us were, you know, accepted in the community, because it's
a particular community, because if you invite us again, we can talk about the Zapatismo movement. Okay. So it was a kind of very isolated population, and it's an autonomous population in Mexico that belongs to the Zapatistas community.
Oh, yeah. I see.
Cuenta la leyenda.
This is La Ventana Americana.
You are listening from the studios of Stanford University, La Ventana Americana.
If you have any questions or want to know more about today's show, you can go to laventanaamericana.com.
And our guests today are Dr. Carla Sandoval Mendoza and Dr. Andres Moreno Estrada,
looking for the Latin American genome.
Now they are very popular, these companies that they are doing the genetical comparison. So they are saying to you, well, you have this group that they are partly African European, so comparing these people have more probabilities to have diabetes against to obesity, so your probabilities of getting
some diseases.
That's the way you do it, mm-hmm. right?
Exactly. So it's a very well contextualized question, I would say, because now very recently we learned that, you know, the leading company that was offering that kind of services, which is 23andMe, just got a warning letter from the FDA, right, saying that they are offering actually basically a medical device without regulation, right? So, and this is depending on how you interpret things, how you look through the regulation lines, right?
They were saying that the people weren't ready to get that information.
Right. So very briefly, and broadly speaking, I would say the following. All we do, actually, as a researchers, has a lot to do with what they do as companies, right? So they do basically two things. And also, I would say that we also generally, in our research projects, also have two broad areas of applications or implications. First is anthropological implications, which is what we do in terms of the genetic reconstruction of the history. Second is the biomedical application of what we do. Exactly the same two are reproduced in these commercial services, right? Because they also were launched as a company offering your own ancestry roots that you can actually give a sample, and we will tell you where you come from. And that's very similar to what we do in research labs. They just put that to the market place, right? Mm-hmm. And it's very attractive. I mean, honestly, I did it myself. I mean, it's like, of course, who wouldn't know to you know where they come from, right? So I have my whole family actually genotyped, and Carla as well, and then our daughter also was sampled.
Yeah.
So definitely something, and also some other people have been calling that like, you know, recreational genomics, because it's just like people say, some would say it's just for fun and something, right? But I think it's a very valid service to say, well, we will offer you the possibility to know, you know, your own roots from the genetic point of view without being part of any research project.
People are responsible and they should have that information. I don't think that they have to regulate that
definitely.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. The problem comes not from that portion of the service. Like I said, there are two broad areas. So one is the one we call the ancestry service, and that was not the issue, right? The issue came with the other part of the service, which is the biomedical part of it, which is basically offering a test for genetic risk for different diseases, right? And that has a lot of interpretation that we need to be aware of now. If, for example, the tests generally are being done in a way that they compare a person's DNA to those variants that have been previously reported as the associated variants with diseases, right? And this is very dependent on previous studies, right? So all what the company is doing is basically comparing all those results from previous researchers or previous publications that have been saying, well, these variants appear to be associated with disease. But as we were talking about for the past moments here is that populations are not the same all around the globe, right? So where those variants have been associated to which disease in which population? So that's where all diversity comes now into place, right? Because if I say, well, this particular variant has been associated with disease and you, customer, tell me that this is your DNA, I can match it with these results depending if you have the same ancestry or not. So they do actually offer these particular, call it, you know, like a disclaimer or something like that. When you have your result, then they say, well, you have this increased risk for this particular disease if you are assuming that you are European, for example, right? And they have a different breakdown menu to choose if you are European or not. Problem is that in most of the cases, it's only European available, right? Because the extrapolation of the result only holds if you are actually European descent, right? So what happens with all our Latin American populations? I would say very shortly, this most likely will not apply. Right? Or at least it would be very difficult to know just like that if all these previous association results will be immediately translated into Latin American populations or not. Because we are Europeans in some parts of our genome, but other parts of the genomes are not European. And it's not a matter of how percentage am I. It's like, am I European in that particular position of this particular variant that is conferring me risk for disease or not? So it has a lot of implications that need to be, of course, interpreted with caution, but regulated. I don't know. So at least each individual would be responsible for the interpretation of it, right?
Yes, well, I think what they were saying is something like that. You can have the data, but you don't have anyone to help you analyze the data. And sometimes they tell you that your risk is higher than the media to have some sort of disease, but then it's higher by 1%. It doesn't mean that you need to take away any organ or anything because 1%, but as there's too much data, there is no way for you to really read a whole book and exactly research what that 1% means, right. Or if it's, as you say, in comparison with some genetic traits or other, from depending of who you are, right, or where you come from. So I think that one of the complaints is that people is getting this without paying for the doctor or someone to tell you, to explain what
right,
it means.
Right. It is definitely a challenge to interpret, definitely. It's true, yeah.
Of social networking websites, but here is one that stands apart for a very special reason. This one has the potential to save lives. It's matchingdonors.com. Matchingdonors.com links organ donors with people in need of a transplant. In the US, 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most for kidneys. If you ever consider becoming a living organ donor, or if you are in need of an organ transplant, visit matchingdonors.com and give the gift of life. What kind of results or clues do you give to the questions of mental health, different issues? Are those also written in the genome?
I mean, some of them they are. I mean, this is the whole field of complex diseases, right? And mental diseases is particularly complex because it's not due to a single particular gene. There are a lot of genes interacting, and this is very difficult to map. However, yes, there are some examples in which some genes have
been
particularly
associated.
Yeah,
I'm not talking about the Down
syndrome,
for example, that is very mappable. I'm talking about obsessive compulsiveness.
Yeah,
I'm
and schizophrenia
about,
and so on.
You are like your father.
No, definitely behavioral traits are inherited, right? The problem with the heritability is that it's just a fraction of the whole trait or the phenotype or the behavior that is explained from the genetic point of view. You know, there are a lot of other factors interacting at the same time, and that is what is difficult to tease apart. How much is that just due to genetics? How much is that the environment? How much is that conditional based on the education or in your experience and all that? So yeah, it's definitely a very open question in the field of genetics. And that's one of the whole labs are just dedicated just to answer that those kind of questions. I want to map the variant that is, you know, associated with schizophrenia and so on, and in particular populations.
How close are we to an answer if the psychologists have to go home?
I would say it depends on the population as well, right? So, I mean, going back to the fact of studying isolated populations, one of the advantages of studying isolated populations is that the variants have been segregating in much more narrow space, right? If you study a large population, chances are that you will need a lot of samples, a lot of thousands of individuals to really get a signal that can confidently map this particular variant to a trait. However, we have examples in our lab that actually have been successful to map a particular variant to a phenotype. That has to be a disease, but a phenotype that characterizes a group of individuals with as few as 100 or 200 individuals. But the advantage is that it was an island, right? It was in the Pacific. Mm-hmm. So in the Solomon Islands, there was a group of individuals that had some of them blonde hair, they didn't have the blonde hair, right? But all of them had dark skin, for example. That was quite striking, right? Something must be going on there. Turns out that actually Emir Kenny, a postdoc, a lab mate with us in the lab, was able to map the particular variant that is causing that blonde hair phenotype in the Melanesians, which turns out to be different as the European variant that causes the blonde hair in Europe. Yes. So I think we have higher chances to map variants that are causing different aspects or phenotypes of the population that characterizes Native Americans.
And you just came back from Easter Island. You were doing some research there. Can you talk a little bit about what you're looking for?
We were collecting some samples there in Easter Island because it's the Rapa Nui population that is very important. And one of the main important of this island is that was the last to be colonized of the Polynesian islands. So because there is a lot of theories about how was settled that island. So the first step is just to collect the samples, and we have also phenotype data. Of course, we have all the permissions and all the informed consents for the population. That is very important to remark. Actually, we are doing the DNA extractions because we collect saliva samples. Today, we finished with the DNA extraction. So, and the next step is to genotype all the samples and just to have a general overview of the genetic profile of the population.
And will you be able to know exactly how they got to the island?
Just the fact of, getting genomic data from one of the most remote places in Earth, that's interesting by itself, right? Just precisely for what Carla just said, it's the very last step, it's the very last island, or at least the three most recent inhabited islands in the Pacific, together with Hawaii and New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So Easter Island, together with these other two, are the very last step of the Austronesian expansion that started in Southeast Asia way, way more recently than any other human expansion. So after all continents were already inhabited, a group of sailors they mastered their skills to go into the ocean, and they basically colonized all the way from Taiwan to northern, of Indonesia, through all the way through the Pacific. Today is French Polynesia, and then after Easter Island. So there is these longstanding questions about not as much as where they come from, because this expansion is very well documented from the linguistic point of view and archaeological and cultural traits. They link way more the Easter Island inhabitants to the rest of the Polynesia culture than with the Americas, for example. Mm-hmm. But still, there's an open question whether these guys made it all the way to the Easter Island only, or they continue further east to actually reach the Chilean coast, or in general to reach the Americas. So that's at least not being supported so far by all the evidences, but still it's an open question to see if there's any evidence of that.
This is La Ventana Americana.
You are listening from the studios of Stanford University, La Ventana Americana.
If you have any questions or want to know more about today's show, you can go to laventanaamericana.com.
And our guests today are Dr. Carla Sandoval Mendoza and Dr. Andres Moreno Estrada,
looking for the Latin American genome. How fast
we humans have evolved in the way, so when you see those genetic trends, we know that we change our skin color depending of wherever we move around the globe. And I suppose humans have been changing after 10,000 years in the continent somehow by the environment, where the food, by the altitude. How fast that gets into the genome? How fast that gets into your genetic material?
That's an excellent question. Yeah. Actually, it takes a lot of time. Normally, if in an outbred homogeneous population, it takes thousands of years. I mean, until a variant is either picked up by natural selection or it appears as a new variant in the population, it takes time until it is propagated to other individuals, and there at the end it rises in frequency until it is really an advantageous mutation that confer the whole population a given ability to do something or whatever, or to survive compared to the others that do not have that variant. So that doesn't mean that we are not evolving. I mean, until we get these advantageous mutation, we are evolving all the time. But the pace is definitely a slow one in terms of, you know, you need to accumulate variants that are changing the population somehow so that it is adapted to the current conditions, right? However, it also is conditioned to the affected population size, right? So also, like we said before about the isolated populations, if a variant is advantageous but the population is too small, it can get fixed, or which means it gets into every single individual much faster than if it's a big population, right? So we hope to understand more about not only their history but also their physiological consequences in terms of the genetic makeup of these populations, right?
There is any genetical combination more adaptative that you have found that live longer? Or I just read something about the 110 club of the Japanese, for example. What kind of mutation, genetically speaking, happened there?
Right. Well, you're giving questions for a whole bunch of research lines. Just one by them could be a whole lab dedicated just one of the single question that you have mentioned, which is true. There are a whole lab dedicated only to understand the genetic basis of aging, for example, right? And to understand why do we get old and how can we control or learn more about the whole process. Of course, with different interests, maybe not to stop it but at least to understand it, right? I mean, what makes people live longer than others? And yeah, there are many studies that have concentrated, you know, elderly groups and then trying to map what make them different, right? But again, there's nothing still super conclusive about this particular gene is the responsible for, you know, getting older or whatever. Like I said before, it's part of the complex phenotype or complex traits in general that are regulated by very many, many different genes in the genome. And you have a whole other host of factors, which is, you know, nutrition, environment, and many different that are very difficult to control in genetics research. But definitely it's one of the most active fields as well.
There is any kind of genetical population in humans?
And
research,
not that we are aware of. No, well, that's also one of the very common beliefs that Carla encounters when she goes in the field. It's like to think, well, you guys come from a genetic lab. We have seen other researchers here come and do stuff with plants, for example, and then do some genetic engineering, and then you can sell it and, you know, clone things. We cannot do that with humans.
Ethics apart. We are talking about good things like maybe clone a liver to transplant or things like that,
Right. I mean, life is so complex itself that, you know, a whole organ or a whole tissue cannot be just cloned by itself. I mean, even not a single cell. I think the very first attempts to do a very first whole sustained artificial cell has been very, very recent. And this is done by, one of the leaders of the whole human genome sequencing project, the Craig Venter, has his own initiative lab now. And I think I haven't read it with detail, but I think he recently managed to have a whole cell that actually is fully sustainable and it's all synthetic, right? So maybe in the future it will, right? But currently it's not possible to do that.
Hungry and homeless people in our community need your help year around. The Bay Area Rescue Mission is a non-denominational Christian social services organization that provides more than 90,000 nights of shelter and approaching 2 million meals annually to the homeless, poor and needy in our area. If you would like to help financially or volunteer some time, call the Bay Area Rescue Mission at 510-215-4555
or go to BayAreaRescue.org.
They do something like it's growing cells or growing from an original human cell. They grow other cells, and from that, many generations after, they can grow a liver, or they actually grow in other organs.
Well, there are actually a whole yeah, those are cell lines, and that is possible. That is done currently already. And also, there's another field of big improvements in which you can only not only take a cell and clone it itself to perpetuate in a cell line, but also you can differentiate from a stem cell, and you can make it appear like another differentiated cell, right, type of cell. And those are the PSMC lines. So that is also very interesting from the, you know, therapeutic point of view. You can take a cell line and then transform it into a skin if you need a skin graft or something like that, right?
Definitely. Or they were growing synthetic leather, for example, so they don't kill cows.
Yeah, trying to grow things. Organs for study, like to help how medicines affect in the research lab some particular organ, so they can test it in a non-real kidney.
You mentioned something about genetically manipulated food, that you could do it in a lab, and that's it. Is it bad for us to consume food?
Not
or
at all.
Alter?
No.
I say, what's the difference between, for example, the roses, how you actually take one rose with another and make a new rose, or the fact that how we domesticated some vegetables like tomato, or how do we, people have been doing this for centuries with vegetables and make this particular fruit sweeter or bigger or whatever to what people is scared of right now.
Isn't it the same to have something genetically altered?
Haven't we been doing that for hundreds of years already?
I mean, it's just a technical term. I mean, ultimately what you're eating, it's the same molecule, right? It's DNA. I mean, DNA and the other molecules that make that particular fruit or vegetable or whatever, but you are eating exactly the same thing. The only difference is that particular species or crop or vegetable comes from a modified DNA, right? I mean, but ultimately the product that you end up consuming has the same sources or material, so it's not harmful at all for us. The concept, however, is kind of, you know, controversial, because it says, well, it sounds like it is not kind of natural or it's not good because it may be artificial. It's just basically that a particular gene in that species has been modified for whatever reason. In this case, mostly to improve their survival in particular conditions, right, under a particular weather, or to be resistant to pathogens or something like that. So most of the cases is to improve the production of a particular crop or something like that. So those are called transgenics, right? So transgenics are very popular all over the world. That's actually, Mexico is one of the biggest, you know, and also in terms of the research that is done, it's actually one of the leaders in trying to improve their own crops into genetically modified species.
So why they are so fighted?
Well, I, like I said, I think there's some fear that, you know, natural variation could be lost as well. And it's certainly something that you have to do carefully in terms of, well, we're going to modify this particular species, but at the same time, you want to keep their diversity, right? Mm. So there's just a
misinformation, would you say?
In some cases,
not?
But it's true that there must be a balance between, you know, the naturally evolving crop that you want also to keep, and then just modify the parts of their genome that you want to modify, right? So I think it's like everything in terms of regulation, not all is good or bad. It's just like, as long as you do a conservative effort to try to first characterize what is the diversity of the crops, and then you want to modify these for a particular reason, you can, you know, commercialize it and then make it available without sacrificing the rest of the natural growing crops.
There's, for example, an animal that is eating a genetically modified crop. If that animal then is being contaminated?
No.
it.
No, because if you think about it again, like I said, in the terms of the whatever the nutrients that the animal will be processing are exactly just the same, right? I mean, the energy will come from the same sources in terms of the, you know, carbohydrates anyway. So the whole machinery of, you know, digesting that food is not modified, and also the animal is not inheriting anything because it's just going in for getting some food and energy. And then it discards the rest. And it's not something that gets transmitted or transfected into the animal's DNA. That's not how it works. I mean, of course, one only can inherit a mutation or something through their parents or actually making, you know, a genetically modified individual, right? So yeah, those are general, you know, beliefs I would say about the whole, which is, by the way, I have to say, outside of our field, we are not experts on any genetic engineering thing.
At least you are closer than many of us on that. So I don't know if this is closer to your field, but how strong is genetic in comparison with environment, culture, in order to fight diseases or personal traits?
It cannot be generalized, definitely. So it's not something that is, well, this much amount of what we are is from genetics and this other amount is from environment and culture and what we learn. I think it's like a case-by-case situation in which, well, this particular trait may be fully responsible from the, you know, fully genetic trait, right? Which there are some that are like that, like, you know, monogenic disorders or things that are controlled only by a single gene that actually either you have the mutation or not, then therefore you have or not this particular trait. But in most of the other cases, the way we act, behave, all those things are, again, like I said, within the complex traits category, right, which are controlled by many interacting factors at the same time. And to put a percentage in each of them, it's just basically depending on the effect of the genetic variants. If we first find it and then we see, well, we can measure the effect of this particular variant, how much of the variation of the trait is explained by just genetic.
From the anthropological studies, Carla, that you've been seeing in some closed communities, you could trace tribes that they were more aggressive than others.
You cannot explain the violence only by genetic traits. I think that you have to take in account all the cultural and social aspects. And for example, in some of the particular native populations, I'm talking just about Mexico, you can see a lot of violence inside, but probably is due to all the external politics that are around these populations. For example, they are not receiving a lot of economical support. There is a big, big, big problem about to consume alcohol in those populations. And when you see that all the social bases are very unequal when you compare it with other populations that are mestizo populations. Yeah,
sure,
yeah.
It was our pleasure. And
thank you so much. And I have to say that our best experiment was a very important DNA recombination experiment that resulted in our daughter, Romina.
I would like to just maybe end by saying that all that we do, I think, has a very important component that could be seen in like two layers of perspective, right? So we have been talking about genetic research done in the lab and experimental work and so on. And all that seems very, not easy, but at least taken for granted that you can actually have that in the lab and then just do it, right? Mm-hmm. I want to stress the fact that it is all very dependent on having a very appropriate and good approach with populations, which ultimately are like ourselves, right? So basically all what we are doing in human population genetics, in contrast to other genetic research areas, is that there is this very complex and sensitive layer of the interaction that you have to have with the populations, which ultimately are just giving you voluntarily a piece of themselves to do your research, right? So that's something that we don't fully appreciate when we do this kind of research, because there are these large consortia currently generating tons of data, and then everybody's rushing to get the coolest result and then have a lot of important results from data that most of the cases, they don't even know where they come from. The large majority of researchers doing the analysis, they haven't even seen the individuals where these samples come from, right? They haven't been in contact with this population. And in some cases, they don't even know all this reality that they are facing out there, right? So all the work that, for example, Carla has been doing in approaching the population one by one in the field. And in some cases, we have not had, you know, the fortune to actually go and sample ourselves. Some other times, we actually do fall into that category of just getting the data because someone else is also working in the field. But in some others, we have been doing the effort of, you know, doing this approach by ourselves, which is ultimately having the population being aware of the richness of what the history they are, you know, bearing in their blood, and not only being a source of samples for your research. It has to be exactly the opposite way. Like, they have to be interested in themselves. They have to be motivated to participate so that both benefit, right? So we can learn from them, but also they can learn from our research, right? So that's why we also try to have a second visit to the community to give back what have we learned from the research, because ultimately none of this research is fixing any of their immediate problems in terms of, you know, social needs or medical needs. And this is just long-term benefits that maybe in a couple of, you know, decades, if we are lucky enough, we will have really some real benefits to population that we study, right? So most of the time it's actually us being benefited from their, you know,
their kind.
They are donors. So to have that understood in their own context is quite challenging. Population genetics involves a lot of ethical and sensitive issues that you have to face in a one-by-one cases. And in particular in Latin America, it's a very diverse and complex region that hopefully we have, you know, we will have the resources to keep studying, but in this consistent way of having multiple layers from the human population approach all the way to the research lab, which is what we're doing here at Stanford.
Well, thank you. And hopefully next time when you come, you can tell me what is the reaction of them when they come back, when you come back with the
results.
With the research.
Exactly. Yeah. The research. Yeah. Looking forward to being here.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank
for
you.
For the invitation.
This is La Ventana Americana.
La Ventana Americana.
La Ventana Americana.
Esto es La Ventana
La Ventana
Americana.
Americana.
La Ventana Americana.
La Ventana de Radio 90.1 KCSU Stanford.
From KCSU Stanford 90.1.
Desde KCSU Stanford.
KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM.
This is La Ventana Americana from KCSU Stanford 90.1.
And the program is La Ventana Americana.
A window to the Latin universe from Stanford to the world.
I am Isabel Jubes.
And I'm Elizabeth Trachtenberg.
Welcome, bienvenido. Welcome to another of my shows. I am your host and producer, Isabel Jubes. This is an archived show of La Ventana Americana. You can find this show and all the information related to it, together with more of my archive productions, on StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org. Visit our website and be part of this, giving me your opinions and more about your ideas.